There's actually a nice synergy between what Hynek was talking about and what I wanted to talk about. This is not my own research, but I think it's important and interesting. Again, it gets back at, we want to think about things at the sea level, not at the pixel level or at the waveform level. Let me talk about what the issue is. Hynek was talking about wanting recognizers to know when they're screwing up. And what I want to talk about is how can we measure audio quality in these devices we're building. And this came out of the hearing aid field, or this interest in this came out of the hearing aid field. My connection with this is through Irv Hafter and Brent Edwards, but there's somebody else who was actually first author. And it's an issue we have all the time in our lab with hearing aids, everything else. It's like, how do you measure the quality of these damn things? You know, they're not working the way we want them to do. We want to get them better, and we don't have adequate measures. And the obvious engineering solution is to use mean squared error, you know, input, you know, output, subtract the two squared, and that gives you an error measure, which is quite fine for many systems, but it's pretty lousy when it comes to auditory, because simple changes like changing the phase doesn't change your perception, but does screw up the mean squared error. So optimizing mean squared error is definitely not the right solution. A common approach, which is much better, is to look at mean opinion score. And mean opinion score, they have trained panels of users who listen to some audio and judge it on this 5-point scale. And for example, I've been hanging out with TTS people, Texas speech people, and they say their system is, you know, sort of levels out at 4.5. So the best you can possibly do with real users is 4.5. But anyway, there's this scale, and it's usually applied to things like cell phones and things like that, where you want to, you know, are you doing a good enough job with the system? Yeah. Well, there are people that try to mimic it. So are you talking about training data for the humans or for machines?
So I imagine your good training data would be a very large set, a diverse set of audio, and then human ratings.
Right. So some of that does exist, and I've seen people build systems to predict MOS. Some friends of ours in Cambridge have done that. And that works great within the range of things they've tested. But the problem is that there's all sorts of ways of screwing up audio that aren't covered by any particular training set. And so, you know, I think within a limited domain, like if you're testing a compression system and you know what kind of artifacts you're doing, you could train a system to do that and you get reasonable results. But I'm very suspicious when someone applies something new. And then the gold standard for these kind of things, especially in the communications industry, is this thing called PESC, which is a perceptual quality metric, which is actually quite brilliant and has its basis in auditory models. So the block diagram looks like this. The idea is you've got some audio coming in the upper left, and that's what you're starting with, and you're going to put it through some device, and that's the cloud thing, system under test. And so you're going to have these two audio sources, or two audio signals that you want to compare. And the way you do it is you essentially line them up, both in level and in time. It's because you don't want to be blind to changes in time and changes in level. And then you run it through an auditory model. And if the spike trains come out identical, then perhaps you haven't changed the audio in any bad way. And so essentially what you're doing is you're doing some alignment, time and frequency, running through an auditory model, and then comparing in the auditory domain whether the two signals are equal or not. And it's very objective. It works great as long as you have a good auditory model. And, you know, as Josh and I were just talking about, you know, not all auditory models represent everything equally well. And so there's, you know, sources of errors. I don't remember. They're pretty primitive. I mean, it's a filter bank, maybe some compression. Do you remember anything more? They're pretty generic, but it's definitely an auditory model, and it's definitely the idea that you want to be in the domain of you know, auditory nerve. And you know, these things fail with things that are not object-like. So you can imagine a speech signal that sounds pretty good, but every once in a while has some musical noise, which is a common artifact in speech enhancement. And musical noise are these little tone-like blips you sometimes hear. And from a signal noise ratio, even in the auditory domain, they're not very big, but they're very non-speech-like, and so they're very noticeable. And so, you know, PESC won't, you know, necessarily do the right thing with that. So I think Herb Hafter at Berkeley was the impetus for this idea. And he was listening to some systems. These are hearing aids, I guess, that his friends are putting together. And he noticed that some listeners claim a subjective improvement for noise reduction, yet has not been shown, these systems have not been shown to improve speech intelligibility, often even making it worse. So, you know, the conventional way of testing these things is, you know, does it improve your intelligibility of speech? You know, can you recognize it better? And, you know, these systems make it worse, which is not a good thing. But yet, people listen to it and say, wow, this sounds really good, or sounds better. And Irv was asking the question, you know, why? And that leads to this idea that maybe a better way of talking about audio quality is listening effort. So instead of trying to say how clean is it or how much like the original it is, what you really care about is how hard do you have to work to listen to it. And you can often, you know, you can just ask people, but that's not very reliable. And so what I want to talk about today are some other ways of doing it that are more objective. The best, well, at least what I can talk about today are these ideas of cognitive behavioral mechanisms for measuring listening effort. And so you look at the effect of these devices or these audio signals on working memory or attention or speed of processing. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But then just by way of contrast, there's a whole bunch of physiological measures you can look at that somehow get at this idea of how much listening effort's involved. And I'll go through all these. I mean, I've got a little bit on each one of these later, so I'm not going to go through all of them. But you can imagine pupil size might matter, or that might be a measure that's useful, or skin conductance, or hormonal responses, or I mean, all these things you can imagine might have some correlation with listening effort. But then what I was going to talk about were these two. And again, this is from this paper from Berkeley, where they use working memory and speed of processing as a way of getting at the underlying difficulty, if you will. And this is, most of this talk is primarily coming from this paper that came out of Berkeley and Starkey. Sarampalas, Sridhar Kulluri, Brent Edwards, and Herb Hafter. And they're very distinguished colleagues. I couldn't find any good pictures of Sridhar or Brent, or embarrassing pictures. But this is what I want to talk about primarily, and I think they did a good job. They started this, well, I don't know if they started this idea. They first brought it to my attention, and then since then there's been workshops and stuff that actually continue the idea. So I like to give them credit for it, and it's been followed up by a number of people. Just by way of making this a little more concrete, the system they tested, or the system they were performing their tests on with real users, was based on this speech enhancement algorithm that was done by Ephraim and Mala 20 years ago. I don't know how it's old. It's sort of the ultimate baseline. It works very well. It's very simple. A lot of people have tried to do better. They sometimes do a little bit better. And until these new DNN speech enhancement systems that are coming out just in the last year or two, it's pretty much state of the art. So it's not the absolute best, but it's pretty close. And the idea is that you've got this signal in red, which is your system, which is your signal and noise. And when you add noise, it increases the floor. And so the red line doesn't go all the way down to the bottom axis because there's noise at it, and that sort of forms a noise floor. And what Ephraim and Mala did was two things. One is a spectral subtraction, which I'll talk about in a second. And the thing that they really did was just clever, which was figuring out where the noise floor is. And so what they want to do is they want to look at the signal, and I drew it as a straight line, but they want to estimate that green dashed line at the bottom. And they do that by looking for the quietest portions of the speech signal, and it's kind of a heuristic, and saying, okay, this must be where the noise floor is. And when they find the noise floor, you can subtract it out. So they're doing this in a spectrogram domain, or a channel-by-channel basis. It's very simple. It's very much dependent on finding these quiet spots, so it's not perfect. And if you're too aggressive, you start getting musical noise. If you're not aggressive enough, you're not doing as good a job. So you know, it kind of takes some tuning and stuff to make it work. And as I said, the two issues that make it not perfect are it's hard to estimate the noise floor, and you know, you get these reconstruction errors. And again, this is really not dealing at all with the noise up here. I mean, up here there's, you know, there's noise, but you're just going to say, let's just subtract it out. So it's not the ultimate noise reduction algorithm. So the experiments that our Berkeley friends did were based on this dual task paradigm. And the idea is that you're listening to some speech and you're performing a task, like you want to understand it, you want to say, you know, it's a cocktail party, whatever's going on, you're trying to understand what's going on. And then you're also measuring performance on a secondary task. And so it's a dual task idea. And if the tasks are completely independent, then they don't affect each other. So the blue lines show the case where you have two tasks that are completely independent. And right now I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Or maybe walking and talking. You can walk just as well whether you're talking or not. And so your performance on task one, walking, you know, is out the blue line no matter how fast you're talking. So that's a case where they're independent. But there's lots of things that have a correlation or not a correlation, a shared resource, where your performance on one task, like, you know, rubbing your tummy, and your performance on the second task, you know, tapping your head, are very correlated, and so you're going to fall on this line somewhere. And so that's going to be the basis of these listening effort tests. So there were two tasks that that the Berkeley folks looked at. The first one was an example of speech perception and noise, and so these are these standardized test sentences. And they have low context and high context versions. So the low context version is something like, she might have assessed the ape. And you could put any word there at all. There's no, the fact that there's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words in front of it, 5 words in front of it, doesn't help you very much at all with a 6th word other than the fact that it's a noun. And then a high context sentence might be, a chimpanzee is an ape. And there's only, what, half a dozen words you can put there. And so having those first 4 words helps you a lot and gives you a lot of context for the last one. The processing, again, is Effer and Mala noise reduction, just very simple. And they did this over 2 different signal noise ratios, plus 2 dB and minus 2 dB SNR, in just some speech babble. And the primary task was to repeat the last word of the sentence. So you can hear these sentences, you just have to repeat it. That seems pretty simple. But then while you're doing that, every once in a while, they would ask you to repeat the last 8 answers you've given. So it's a memory task. yeah. You thought this was going to be easy. and the important thing is you're not trying to repeat the last 8, you're not repeating the last 8 last words. It's the last 8 words you remember that you already answered. Sorry, the last 8 answers. So these are independent things. The first one is, you know, did you recognize the word? And the second one is, can you remember the words you said? So they're fairly independent in that sense. And this is what the results look like. In the high sorry, it's fairly busy. I should have made an animation out of it. But the left side is the high context case. So you really know what the word's coming next because there aren't many choices. And as you expect, is there a laser pointer up here? The screen's too tall for me. Oh. I'm gonna do the analog. I'm not using a blackboard, so I'll use this. So you know, as you increase the signal noise ratio, I'm sorry, as you decrease the signal noise ratio, add more noise, performance goes down. And they didn't see much difference between processed and unprocessed on this task, which is number of words correctly identified. So with 2 dB, you got what, almost 90% correct, and with minus 2 dB, you got, you know, 70% correct. And then when you lose the context, so in this case there's no context, it could be any word following, but the overall performance goes down. And then they see a small but not significant difference in the performance in the hardest case. So this is the absolute hardest case. Low signal noise ratio, no context. There's a small but, you know, not really significant difference. So they call that a wash. So that's the primary task. The secondary task is more interesting. So in this case, you're looking at the number of words correctly recalled, and people do pretty well, I mean, above 50% on these 8 words. And in the no context case, in the hardest case, they didn't see much difference. But they did see a significant difference in the high context case here, where in the process case, you can remember more words than in the unprocessed case. So the noise reduction algorithm, you know, didn't help with the primary task, which is, you know, can you hear the words? But it did make it easier to recall the words later. And so the idea is that, you know, the speech was easier to understand in the process case. It didn't actually help your speech intelligibility, but it did take less resources. And so you had more time to memorize. They're not hanging the whole paper on this idea. I mean, I think barely significant was in the paper. I mean, from here to here. No. Here to here. Yeah, this is not significant. This is. Yeah. Right. I forget whether it was a 0.01 or 0.05 threshold, but you know, it was just barely whatever threshold they used. Perhaps, yeah. This is the weaker half of the story. So, I mean, this is suggestive. This is the other part of it that I think is interesting. It's also very complicated. So look at this side first. There's two effects going on in this word recall case. So this is the word recall as a function of signal noise ratio and word position. So, you know, you're doing this test and you're hearing all these sentences, and at some point they say, stop, what are the last eight answers you gave? And it turns out there's this conventional U-shaped curve. So you're really good at the last word because you just heard it. And you're really good at the first word because you've been practicing for a long time. And then there's this, you know, characteristic curve like this, where in the middle you sort of forget what you're doing, or forgot what you did, or forgot what you said.
So you're really good at remembering eight words back?
It's not the eight. You're really good at remembering the first word of the test, the first sentence you heard.
You do exactly eight things and stop.
Right.
You know when the stop is, you know when the started. You know when the first one was.
Yeah, that's true. I guess you do, right. Otherwise, this wouldn't be high. Yeah. Right.
So it's not that they're randomly stopping people.
Right, you're right. Yeah, Dick is right. The only reason this would work is if you knew when they started. So you start a block, and this is the first one. You practice it all along. But they did see, so they didn't see much difference in here. But in the high context case, they said there was a significant improvement in the lowest signal to noise ratio, which is these squares, between the unprocessed and the processed. So here it's almost 10% improvement in performance on the secondary task, on the very first word. And again, they argue, well, actually, I'll let them say it. When context information was available, rehearsal, which is what gives you this first part, was facilitated by providing noise reduction processing, at least at the lowest SNR tested. So only in this case did they see a significant difference.
So some resource was being used up that was then freed up to some extent by noise reduction.
Thank you. I can go home now. My job is done.
Only for first word position or?
That was the only one they cited. I mean, I don't know if these are significant or not. I mean, it definitely isn't over there. You know, maybe not there, I don't know. In the paper, they only talked about the first word. And that was their evidence for the statement. So the second test that they did was a combined auditory visual task. And so again, the speech with these IEEE sentences, which are standardized, the processing was a lot like before, but they went down even lower signal noise ratio, down to -6. And two tasks. The primary task was to repeat the entire sentence. Simple enough, right? And we're going to score them on how well they heard it, recognized it, and repeated it back. That sounds easy. The secondary task was there was going to be some little boxes on the screen. And they're going to, you know, come up, you know, arbitrary times, unsynchronized, and they had to type in the number they saw. So they had to keep track of these two boxes, and while they're repeating sentences, they're going to see these numbers and they have to type in the number on the screen. And it, I'm sorry, one digit numbers, just one digit. And, huh? It depends how seriously you take it. And then they're going to measure the reaction time. So the idea is that if this is really easy, then you'll be able to put more effort into this task, and your reaction time will stay lower, go lower, or whatever. So these are the results I got. In the primary task, which is shown on the left, as you expect, the ability to repeat back the sentence goes down as you decrease the signal noise ratio, as you add noise. This is exactly what you'd expect. The performance on this task would go down. But the interesting part was that in the secondary task, which is typing the digits in, the reaction time went way down in the process case. And so, you know, and they say this is a significant improvement. They didn't say it's barely. They said it's significant, going from, what, 0.69, point 0.75 or so down to 0.69 of a second. And they summarize these results by saying, this finding suggests that at this low signal noise ratio, use of a noise reduction algorithm may free up cognitive resources that would otherwise be involved in extracting speech from noise, allowing them to be allocated to other simultaneous processing tasks. And it's all because of this. You know, this processing, you know, created a significant reduction in reaction time on this visual task. So that's what our Berkeley friends presented. And I wanted to mention some other approaches. These largely came from a workshop that was held maybe a year ago now, to sort of follow up on these listening effort ideas. So there's a lot, it seems to be a lot of interest, at least according to my friends in Berkeley, in this idea of having listening effort as a metric for quality.
So going back to the previous thing, sir. So I think this is on average over whatever 10 subjects or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did they publish like what the individual differences are, or is it like is everybody doing better, so to speak, in the name, or are some people maybe showing the opposite effect?
They didn't talk about inter-subject differences, but there's some other stuff that comes up a few slides down where we did see some differences based on age that might be relevant to your question. Anything else on the Berkeley efforts before I talk about some other things that people have done? Yes. Well, yes. I mean, I've seen. The proceedings of this workshop had like 6 or 8 papers that all, you know, did various kinds of things and seemed to say, yes, this is valid. I mean, the problem with these dual task experiments is, one, it's really hard to figure out what the two tasks could be. And two, you know, there's this careful titration to make the two tasks appropriate so you get some curve that makes sense. And so, you know, these results are not spectacularly wild and wonderful and big and stuff like that, but I think it's an important idea. And hopefully other tasks will be designed that, you know, show a bigger result.
So where is this resource being potential?
Well, it depends on the two tasks. So in the first task it was memory. Let's assume memory, I mean, because they're both memory tasks. And so, you know, or putting things into memory might be the issue. I don't know. There's some sort of rehearsal going on. And so saying it's memory or something else is hard. But I would probably call it memory. In the second case, there's an example on a couple of slides where I talk about how people process sounds that are hard to hear. And in that case, it might be, you know, you can only do one thing at a time. And if you're listening to the speech and you don't quite understand it, then you have to go back and say, oh, what did I hear? And you sort of analyze it in your brain about what you heard or what you could have heard. And so that takes you away from the visual task. So in that case, it's an attentional limit or a thinking limit. The people that do this kind of work like to draw these kind of, you know, block diagrams where, you know, you have some stimulus coming in, there's a primary memory thing, there's some rehearsal going on, and then eventually it might show up in secondary memory and, you know, things fall through to the bottom. And that's the sort of bottleneck that the people have is, you know, how much time can you spend rehearsing? There's a bunch of effort on physiological measures for listening effort. And this is from this paper Well, there's no date. This is the volume that has all the information, but and there's no year on it, so I can't tell. But they looked at two different measures of physiological measures of effort. And it turns out that, well, the two they looked at was heart rate variability and skin conductance. And it turns out that when you're resting, there's a lot of variability in heart rate. And as you work harder and harder, the heart rate variation goes down. And I think that's because, I don't think they talked about it in this paper, but I think that's because, you know, as you work harder and harder, your heart rate's going up, and there's just less room for variation. But you see a correlation between, you know, doing nothing, normal speech, and fast speech, in this case, with heart rate. And then they also looked at the skin conductance. So, you know, the skin conductance is low, and then as you're getting more and more stressed, or as you're working harder, the skin conductance goes up. So that's another metric we use for measuring listening effort. There's some age differences for those of us that are above the age of, 30 or 40, I guess. This is a case where they were asking people to listen to some digit strings and then repeat back the words at some position in the past. So if you're asking people to, you know, to give the number 1 back, then they can do really well, but 2 back is harder and 3 back is even harder. And they did this both in an audio case and an audiovisual case. And I think the audiovisual case was just people speaking. So it was listening to some digits, either from audio alone or listening to someone say it. So you get to see and hear it. And it turns out that the young listeners were better able to use the audio signal, I'm sorry, the visual system, than the older people. And they don't offer any explanation. And the results are kind of weird because, you know, the older people do almost as well as the younger with audio only. But, you know, there's definitely a big difference here between the audio only and the audio visual. For the young people, so the way you integrate this, and this is, I just put this up here because, you know, there's definitely age-related differences in all this. Someone asked about, I forget what the question was, but there's this model that people have put in about how people understand language, understand speech, and the basic idea is you've got this language coming in or this speech coming in. And you're putting some effort into understanding it, and then it goes into some sort of processing that's trying to understand it all, and that's what's shown down here. And if it's all consistent with what you're expecting, then everything's happy and you understand and you're done. And the problem happens is what happens when something happens that you don't quite understand. And then there's this big box here that's effortfulness processing of speech. And that's when you've heard some speech, you don't understand it, you're trying to fit it into what you've heard or trying to reanalyze it, what's going on. And so there's this loop going on here where you try to, you know, put more effort into it. And that's definitely, you know, one of the issues that comes up with understanding speech and listening effort. And, you know, that's the box that's killing us. Again, there's more boxes like this, and I'm going to skip it. This is just showing about, you know, there's only so many things you can attend to at once. And sometimes you can think about splitting your attention, but it's essentially one. And then there's all sorts of other issues that are more subtle. You know, certainly you can measure stress in many ways, and that's going to correspond with listening effort. And I really like this book because it talks about how stress infects your entire life and the people that follow you in as your children. And it's actually quite quite interesting for lots of reasons. But they don't say anything about speech effort in the book. Just out of curiosity, does anybody know what this word means? I've given this talk several times. No one has any clue. I didn't know it was a real word. No. Well, he has very little coordination, I guess. So, yeah, maybe. So, finally, implicit in all this is how much effort do you want to put into learning the problem, or learning the speech, or understanding the speech, and that's what coordination is all about. So, in all these experiments, there's also this human desire, or how much desire does the subject have, to actually learn it. So in conclusion, this is from the Berkeley paper. Well, actually, this is Brent Edwards' follow-up to all this. Patients who are hard of hearing do not primarily seek hearing help because they have noticed poor audibility of soft sounds. You know, they're not coming into the office because they can't hear soft sounds. They're coming in because they can't function in complex everyday environments and demanding listening situations. So they're coming in because they can't understand speech in restaurants or, you know, in reverberant environments or things like that. You know, no one ever comes in, or not a lot of them. They don't primarily come in because sound is too soft. So it's these difficult things, and so we need to do a better job of responding to them. They complain of poor environmental awareness, inability to distinguish different talkers in group conversation, and increased listening effort and fatigue from extended communications interactions. So, you know, those of us above the age of 20 were probably really feeling it at Los Algabos the other night where it was so noisy inside the inside the restaurant. And then finally, in conclusion, furthermore, these results suggest that the benefit of using a digital noise reduction algorithm is not in making speech more intelligible, but rather in reducing the cognitive effort involved in the task. This can be seen as an improvement in performance in a simultaneous task. So I really think that we should be paying attention to this. It's a hard thing to measure, but it's important. Mean squared errors are not the answer. I think we've all learned that. PASC and MAS are pretty good. And we've gone a long way with that. And we need to start thinking about cognitive measures of effort and performance. And listening effort is one way. Something I worked on before was measuring comprehension. So we were looking at speeding up speech, and we used comprehension as a metric for quality. But again, you know, that takes listening to longer passages and making estimates. So that's all I have to say. For some things.
But like, could you actually need to evaluate, you know, source separation algorithms?
No. Because it doesn't have any concept of objectness, and we're pretty sensitive to object formation. So in some ways, people are really good at ignoring, you know, objects that are not part of speech. So, you know, it's too quiet here. You know, if I'm doing this, you can ignore it pretty well, and that's going to affect your score. But, you know, how that figures into MAS is hard to say. MAS was really designed, and MAS was really designed for single speech, and PASC was, you know, sort of a way to instrument that. Yeah, people have used recognizer output or recognizer likelihoods as a measure.
How well does that work? That must work better than
PASC. It works. I haven't seen it take off. Have you?
No, we had a project that trained the network to predict MAS scores, and it worked pretty well on what it was trained on, and you know, we thought maybe you could use that to optimize a synthesizer or something, but it didn't generalize well enough to be that useful.
But like, you know, imagine you have some network that's been trained on like, you know, an enormous corpus, you know, let's just take your best system, right?
Yep.
And then measure distortion, you know, seven layers in.
It seems like it should work.
Yeah, like what, well, that's got to do something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
the visual people have an easier problem in some cases because the objects are not transparent, and we have transparent objects, and that makes things a lot harder.
If you were to do that, would it be better to take a shallow layer, or?
I don't know.
Which makes more sense?
And did they have some human quality judgments to train that on, or did they?
They compared it to human quality judgments.
But how did they train?
The training was just done on ImageNet.
Oh, so
and then they tried to regress on some other. Actually, no, they didn't even regress on anything. They just took it and they did some sort of I'll find the paper. I'll send it out. I don't think they're trained on anything.
It might be just a bottle, using it like a bottleneck layer.
They use the bottleneck layer.
Or you just measure a quality metric like Enoch was talking about that doesn't depend on training data? How applicable is it?
Sort of, I think it was something like that, but I'll look it up and send it out.
Jonathan.
Not really a question, it's more of a comment. The physiological metrics, there's a lot of open potential there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are very strongly correlated, some are less correlated.
Mm-hmm.
Pupillometry, is a direct measure of what's going on with the autonomic nervous system.
Right.
Alpha is a measure of effort, but also a measure of intention. There may be some hope of using multiple sources of those, getting a better measure than anyone.
I agree. I think that'd be great. I'm not sure where it would start if I was doing that myself, but it'd be nice to have some of those.
Also, it seems to me like another challenge of doing these kinds of things with audio is my sense is that audio is more heterogeneous than images, in the sense that it may be related to the fact that there are a handful of subdomains that are very important to humans and that are statistically very distinct with speech and music.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly find that, if you just run sparse coding algorithms on audio, the results will depend a lot on what kind of corpus you use. Whereas for images, the results are very robust for the particular type of images that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Image statistics just seem to be pretty consistent across different domains. And so, I think, what may work well for, what may constitute an artifact in speech that's very objectionable for speech.
I think that's fair. The visual people also have a easier time of features in the sense that everything's written a topic, and it's not clear what the right features for audio are. Pardon?
You can see them.
You can what?
You can see them.
Yeah, in the right. When we did the audio morphing work many years ago, we thought it was really important to keep track of the pitch as being separate from the timbre. And so the whole work that we did in audio morphing was based on this idea that pitch signals are independent, perceptually independent of timbre and things like that. And so when we did the morphing, it was important to morph the pitch independent of the timbre. And you can imagine if you screw that, we saw this, if you screw it up, if you just did a crossfade between these two harmonic stacks, then you get this little blurble in the middle, which is really noticeable because it sort of violates the idea that it's a single object morphing from one to another. And doing it right required doing the separate timbre and pitch thing. And if you do that, then it's really smooth and it really sounds like an object.
It sounds like an object the whole way through.
Yeah. I mean, it's as you expect, the harmonic complex goes from this to this.
Yeah.
But if you do a crossfade, in the middle somewhere, it's going to be beating. And that generates this musical noise. And so that gets at the reason I brought that up is because it's, really hard to know what the right metric is. And I believe pitch is an independent metric, an independent dimension of perception than timbre. And so you might want to, consider those separately.
That's a pretty scary. Well, I understand that there are other measures than intelligibility, but still the prime goal of speech communication is to understand each other.
Right.
So what is the problem in measuring intelligibility? Is it cost? Or is it that people sort of can't get enhancement, which I affect, and then they come with all kinds of other
things. Well, that's what was showing in the first experiment, going all the way back. The intelligibility was the same. There.
Yeah.
But yet one was easier to understand than the other. Well, no, it's interesting. Intelligibility is important,
uh-huh.
But making it easier for people is probably more important. Well, I think it is. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh. I understand that, there are other measures besides intelligibility, but sometimes I suspect that since we cannot get enhancement of intelligibility, no matter what we do or not, then we come with all kinds of other things.
So it's very hard to get enhancement of intelligibility for people with normal hearing because their hearing system is so good at dealing with the noise. But for people with hearing impairment, it ought to be possible, and it has been shown to be more possible.
Yeah.
Also, for a processor to put in front of a lousy codec, like in a cell phone, doing some noise reduction first can improve the net intelligibility. So these are, you could measure with hearing impaired people, or you could measure with lousy codecs, or you could measure listening efforts some other way. These all kind of get at the effectiveness of the noise reduction, even though the first order thing you would want, maybe improving intelligibility, you can't have with normal hearing people.
You're next.
For people whose hearing is impaired, and you said that they're complaining about, you know, they don't need to amplify soft sounds. What they really need is, you know, cocktail party attention. Is it known whether those people have cortical complications? Like, do they have cortical damage? Or is it, well, only known that they have cochlear issues?
Someone talked about this yesterday, right, about the timing issues with as you get older. I forget who that was. Was it you? So, there's definitely issues where your ability to represent time goes down, and it shows up in balance, and it shows up in your ability to localize, I think, and we think it shows up in your ability to recognize speech. You know, the timing goes down. Who was talking about the shiny myelin? Is that you?
Yeah. It's not just cortical. Yeah. It's central. Because imagine that if a cochlear implant could make the output a little bit closer to normal, that the cortex could adapt and take care of the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the fact that it blatantly cannot suggests that either the cochlear implant is like doing a transformation that is nowhere near similar to normal, or that there's some cortical damage, or both.
Yeah, I mean, it's all there. We're trying to get Heather Bortfield to come in a couple weeks, and she does a lot of stuff in that area with cochlear implants. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. My favorite example is people can actually learn Morse code as a language. So you have one channel, and you don't hear individual dots and dashes. You hear it as a pattern, a texture. And, you know, people that do Morse code really well, I mean, lots of hours, hear it as fast as speech. So it's pretty wild to hear and see.
They have Morse objects, but they don't hear the individual.
Yeah. I mean, I was very, very primitive at it. I got like 5 words a minute. But, you know, I definitely got to a case where I heard, you know, cat was a particular pattern, and I could hear that. So.
What about elephant?
Always a wise crack.
That's another comment about aging. The visual system also has a related problem.
Oh.
It's not quite as bad. But if as you're older, your peripheral vision gets worse, and you can go in and get glasses and get the but you may still prefer large print, even with your glasses. I think that's much more subtle than what we're seeing with cochlear party listening. But it's possible that the two communities can learn from each other.
That's interesting. Timing is so important to audio signals. And maybe the issue is with scanning text or something. You can't scan it as well as you get older or something. Maybe, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if that.
The edges are just not as clear, even though
they're
going into the retina just fine. But beyond that, the edges get messed up.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else? Thank you. This has been fun.